Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Tonight's program is a special evening with two of very brave and illuminating theater artists, Danny Hawk and Jerry Quickly. It is co-presented with the Center Theater Group, and this is our first collaboration with Center Theater Group. We're really delighted, and we trust that it will be one of many others in the future. The conversation, the format tonight is a conversation between Danny and Jerry. And after they talk for a while, we will invite you into the conversation. We ask that you wait until the microphone comes to you because we do record for podcast and we'll have it up in a few weeks. Poet Jerry Quickly has toured his work widely and performed in venues such as the Royal National Theater, and he's received multiple commissions from the Mark Taper Forum in Los Angeles. He contributes to a variety of books and publications, including Spoken Word Revolution, Slam Hip Hop and the Voice of a New Generation, and Twilight of Empire, Responses to Occupation. He can be seen in the documentaries A Night of Ferocious Joy, Spit Slam Nation, Poetic Justice, and the PBS documentary Senior Year. This year, Jerry is a fellow at Stanford University, and he came down for this evening, and we're very thankful that he did. Danny Hawk is an actor, playwright, and director whose plays Pot Melting, Some People, and Jails, Hospitals, and Hip Hop have garnered many awards, including two Obies and an Alpert Award in the Arts. His theater work has toured the U.S. and abroad. He's a senior fellow at the New School's Vera List Center for Arts and Politics, and his writings on hip-hop, race, and class have appeared in many publications. Since in 2000, Mr. Hawk founded the Hip Hop Theater Festival, and they have a great website as well, which has since presented over 100 hip-hop generation plays from around the globe. He's currently appearing at the Kirk Douglas Theater in my hometown, Culver City, which has seen some gentrification. You can pick up a flyer in the lobby. The show opens on January 21st and runs through February 22nd. It's a one-man show, which brings to vivid life the residents of his Brooklyn neighborhood. Ben Brantley in the New York Times described it as a fiery, polemical portrait gallery of a play, going on to say, "The extravagantly talented Mr. Hawk has been channeling restless souls. He's a specialist in placing invisible people in the line of vision of folks who might otherwise never see them." So please welcome Jerry Quickly and Danny Hawk in a conversation titled Gentrification, Neo-Feudalism, and the Colonists on Your Block, The Real Costs of a Latte.
How are y'all? Thanks for coming. Where are my index cards? Feeling very Liptonian tonight. Randomly picking one of the index cards. Danny Hawk, what is it that you hate so much about white people?
Let's see. Our cluelessness and sense of entitlement.
Exactly. I'm very happy to be having this conversation with Danny tonight, and we were speaking backstage a few minutes ago, and one of the things that really strikes me about gentrification is how you're never the source of it. You know, it's always the people that came after you. I was dating someone a couple of years ago, and she had been living in New York and moved there right after she got out of college, and around 92, 93, she moved to Hell's Kitchen or Clinton Hill, whatever the fuck they're calling it lately. And, can I curse on the podcast? Oh, sorry. Okay, I'm sorry. So she fucked up. And she, you know, was making these assertions about how, like, oh, well, you know, the neighborhood's really changed. It's got a love scale, and it's this, and it's that, and this gentrification has happened, like, after I got there, you know, from Coral Gables or wherever she was from. And I was like, well, you know, the gentrification in that area didn't start in 92 or 93. It actually started, like, early to mid-'80s when they started renaming it and everything else. So, you know, you're part of this gentrification. And she's like, no, it's the others from New York. And, you know, she's like insistent, like kind of like really trying to grapple with it. You know, that, well, that and the fact that she dated me shows a series of bad choices in her life. But ultimately, it really, it spoke volumes to me about the denial that like so many of us exist in. Like me living in Hollywood in a rent-controlled apartment I've lived in for 15 years doesn't change the fact that even though Hollywood was kind of run down and gully in 1994, that I'm still part of that wave of gentrification that turns my stomach and I can't stand now. In terms of the research and work that you did kind of looking at preparing to do your theater piece, how big a role did denial, or the kinds of denial I'm describing, or other forms of denial play in terms of the role that people have, or the non-role they imagine themselves having in gentrification?
Well, I didn't really research this play. I didn't want to write it, actually. I think, you know, it had been in my mind for 10 to 15 years because it was in my face and happening to my neighborhood and to New York City for, you know, half of my life. But the denial thing is something that I was aware of and I had to be really careful about, because the problem is that when people come to the theater, they're feeling really enlightened just when they walk in the door. And they're feeling and then they come to see me and they think they're feeling really progressive. Right, exactly. So I was like, well, you know, basically, I have to indict everybody, including myself, in the process. And people got really angry and really indignant because they were like, I'm not the problem. I contribute. I'm a teacher. I voted for Obama. You can't tell me I'm guilty. I volunteer. I'm on the left. So why are you pointing the finger at me? Don't include me in your line of fire. And it became really difficult. So I got all these letters, you know, people like, I mean, vehemently, like, against, you know, like, I agree with what you're saying that this is happening, but I'm not guilty.
But.
Yeah. And I was like, wow, this is really something else. It's like a whole backlash happening. I have a real estate developer character, and there's real estate developers who come to the show. And the real estate developer character is kind of like a tyrant, if you will, in the show. But he says a lot of really true things, so you can't really dismiss him. And the real estate developers come to the show and they're like, this is great, I love this show. But, you know, like the housing activists are like, what are you saying? Because the irony is that in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where I live, there's a whole storefront of housing activists, none of whom are from New York City. And the irony escapes them.
You know... Blink, blink. You know, they, yeah, this kind of dewy-eyed blink. Do you understand the irony? gentrification clearly is something that, you know, is everyone deals with in one level or another, or chooses not to. It happens all over the country. And I want to expand it to, you know, certainly include other regions in Los Angeles, the Bay, and many other, Miami, lots of other places. But let's stick for a moment with New York. You know, I was born and raised in New York City, and what I find really, one of the odd hallmarks about New York is that people will move there to go to college, or they'll move there after college, and you ask them where they're from, and they'll say New York. You know, like there's some real cachet or something being from New York. And I don't know about you, but it annoys the fucking shit out of me. I can't, it just, when people do that, it's just like, well, you're from wherever you're from. There's nothing wrong with that. It's great if you love this city and want to live here for the rest of your life. But, you know, I they had no idea of, like, the hardship of growing up in New York in the late 60s, 70s, early 80s, and what that meant for a child to have to kind of experience that. But, and it's more kind of like this co-opting of a culture or an adopting of something that they hadn't actually done. And I think that that mood that's kind of somewhat specific to New York, it's somewhat New York-centric, but it is part of, it's also linked to many of the same currents that come with gentrification. So am I on the pipe?
You're on the pipe.
Okay.
Not the crack pipe, but the right pipe. You know, I think it's hard for someone who grew up like myself in New York City also during that blight, to see the city cleaned up and see these amenities all of a sudden with a swath of people that are clueless and indifferent about them, right? And it's not that we don't like these new things and we don't like these amenities, but at what price? And one of the letters that I got that I actually read out loud in my show, so be careful if you write me a letter, is this guy who says, you know, I volunteer, or not I volunteer, I teach art, I contribute, I teach kids art for free, and I've been here for 10 years struggling. I contribute to my neighborhood, and more importantly, I spend money here. I contribute. So you cannot tell me that after 10 years of spending money here and struggling that I'm not a New Yorker. My wife and I are trying to buy a house and we can't afford to live here. And it's all fundamentalists back home in North Carolina. There is no future there, he says. And I feel like it's not to diminish what this guy's sense of struggle is, because everybody's struggle is relative. But I think what happens, particularly with college students who come to New York City and other cities, is that there's, I know it's going to be a sigh when I say this, but there is a simulated struggle that happens in moving to a city. For instance, the young college student from suburban, I don't know, Iowa or Southern California, Orange County, is that right? Okay. Moves and goes to NYU, and, you know, the first week she's in New York, she gets robbed. And then she moves into an apartment, and the landlord, you know, is obviously, you know, iffy, and there's roaches, and, you know, there's not enough heat in the winter, and she's dealing with New York things.
It's
and
like
it's,
theme park struggle.
Yeah, it's a simulated struggle, but there's a sense of struggle because you're dealing with it in a new environment that you're not used to. And then you feel like, wow, I'm kind of struggling. And maybe you see some ugly shit, right? So you're like, wow, I'm really living here, right? I'm like, for the first time, I feel alive because someone got shot down the block. But it's not the actual struggle of having lived in the crack epidemic or the gun epidemic or the AIDS epidemic or the Giuliani epidemic.
They can't walk down the block and point to, like, this is where, like, the police shot Brandon, and this is where the police punched out Marie and her teeth fell on the floor there, and this is where the ambulance ran over the curve and blah, blah.
But they're happy to, because of the history that they heard, because it provides this cachet. And I think that what's happening, it's not just, this isn't just an issue that's about what's happening in our cities. It's an issue about what's happening in the rest of America, because economically and socially, we have these huge suburb communities that are bereft of what healthy communities are supposed to have. So that's why kids are flocking to the cities. It's part of why. Because they're like, hey, I want to live in a real place and eat real food and listen to real music and feel like I'm alive. I don't want to live in a subdivision because this doesn't feel like community. So they come to Los Angeles and they come to San Francisco and Oakland and Chicago and New York and other cities to simulate this struggle. But it's a different kind of struggle, and ultimately, collectively, those people, because they're not rich, most of them, they wind up running over people in the street.
I think in some ways what you're getting at is almost like a strain of what, in a more general sense, what I would call Americanism. And what I mean by that is a unique ability that we seem to possess on a macro level in the culture to have an incredible disregard and insensitivity to other cultures or the value of other cultures unless we're directly benefiting from it or unless it directly affects our lives in some positive way. You know, like a culture that we're unfamiliar with, that we're not close to, is often, and the we being all of us, like I'm not excluded from this group, you know? And if it's a culture that we're not getting anything from or that we're not connected with, it's not just that it's out in the world, it's not treated with the same care, respect, or humanity that you would your own culture. And you don't have to, you know, kind of join hands and like kumbaya, but at the same time, there's, you know, there is this kind of harsh insensitivity, and it becomes this exercise in almost like navel gazing, you know, like we're the most important, we're the, I have a friend who teaches music in Topanga to little kids, and the parents all got together and like, well, we have to talk about you and whether or not you are appropriate or musical instructor for, and I was like, what is wrong with these people? Like, they just have too much time and money on their hands. They should march us, those kids into Afghanistan for 4 years and try to like making it on a ranch or something there, growing vegetables, you know, in the Kush Valley, and then come back to Topanga and realize, you know what? It really is pretty safe here. It's okay. You can teach the kids violin. You know, there's a sense of we have so much that we don't have an appreciation for how safe and stable things are. And we look for problems where there are none. And with that, I think that's part of the source of that insensitivity. Am I just on some crazy shit?
No, but I think it's not an insensitivity. It's a sense of entitlement that really comes from colonialism. You know, it's funny because when I was touring my last piece in Latin America, and when I was telling them about this new show that I was doing, I was saying, you know, it's about gentrification, and I was telling them in Spanish, but there's no word for gentrification in Spanish. So I was trying to explain to them what gentrification is. Like, do you have that in Buenos Aires, in Mexico City? And they said, oh, you mean colonialism? because that's the only applicable word. And I think that we don't like to think of gentrification as colonialism because we don't like to think that in a nation or a land that has already been colonized, that we can recolonize spaces. And that's essentially what happens. It's like I was talking with this writer about white privilege and entitlement, and I kept sort of spitting back this about the housing activists, you know, from Ohio and Wisconsin that are in Brooklyn.
Blink, blink.
And right, and she was saying, but what are we supposed to do? What are we supposed to do? Just tell me, what are we supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? Move back? Yeah, and it's not that that's the solution. I don't know what the solution is, but saying what's the solution to gentrification is like saying what's the solution to colonialism. We're in this
from
place,
your veranda,
right? From your veranda or from your cafe. The solution is what community are you in, and what community are you invested in, and how do you contribute to that, and what community did you leave? Because part of me feels like, and people get upset when I say this too, that all of the progressive Democrats and leftists that fled the 50 states and moved to California and New York are responsible for the last 8 years of George Bush. Because we're talking about collectively, those are millions of people in red states. And what would happen in those two elections if those people did not move to New York and Chicago and Los Angeles and Oakland? Literally, what would have happened? Well, what would have happened is they would have had to stay in Kansas. They would have had to think about, who is my community? And what do I have to do here to survive and to struggle here? And how do I fight against the fundamentalists or work with them? Or how am I going to create a theater company in Kentucky instead of in New York, you know, competing against me for arts funding? And those are not glamorous things to think about. Those are ugly things. Maybe not ugly, but they're difficult because you really have to think about, okay, I have to do work now. I can't go have a simulated struggle in Fort Greene, Brooklyn. I have to, like, work in my community. And, like, that's not a pretty thought growing up in America.
You know, at the same time, you know, I agree with most of what you said, and I reflect back on a year or so ago, I was touring a play, and I was performing at a school in Kansas, and it was at this fairly small university, and there were these protesters there. The play was about Iraq, and there were these protesters there who came out to, you know, there's a write-up in the papers, there's a picture of me and a description of the play, whatever, and these protesters came out to protest the play, and they were protesting against abortion, you know. And so this is like, I was just like, what's happening in Kansas? You know, like, what's wrong with Kansas? Like, what is wrong with these people? This has nothing to do with abortion. I don't even mention abortion in the play. I'm not aware, of course, I support a woman's right to choose, but I'm not aware of any publishing that has been put out in the world. And so, and I kind of think, well, then what is it like? For me, it was odd as a visiting artist. I was like, this is pretty bizarre. But what would it be like to grow up in that environment? And what would it be like to feel, you know, stifled by the reality of, like, you go to see, you know, someone kick some poems on a rock, and there's these anti-abortionists in your face, you know, like, you know, die, you Jew, and, you know, and they, because there was a lot of racism and anti-Semitism and, like, lots of vulgar racial slurs. It wasn't like they were just, hey, down with, you know, down with abortion. It was this ugly gathering. And so to grow up in a place like that, I can certainly understand the desire to kind of to flee, but at the same time, there's like an absence of ownership of what happens when you flee and the impact you make on the place you decide to land in.
There's also an option, and I think this is key. You know, I hear from a lot of people, well, I didn't have a choice. Like, I couldn't stay in rural Pennsylvania if I wanted to be a filmmaker. I had to move to New York. What was I supposed to do? What was I supposed to do? We like to say that in this country. What was I supposed to do? I had no options. And I often get this question, like, well, what's the difference between, you know, a bunch of Americans moving to a neighborhood and changing it and immigrants? And the difference is the option. Because immigrants, generally, when they move to a neighborhood, they're not moving to the neighborhood with economic wealth. They're moving with sweat equity and very little economic wealth, very little money, actually. And Americans, no matter how poor we may think we are when we move into a community, we're moving with economic wealth, albeit collective, and very little sweat equity. We move with our minds, you know. We're not coming there to clean toilets. We're coming there to be a filmmaker or a yoga teacher or volunteer.
But we pay to have the toilets cleaned.
Right. So then what happens? You know, and again, you know, immigrant communities don't turn over, you know, just because white folks move in from Arizona. You know, there's second generation, and there's upward mobility. It's like, okay, we're moving out of the city, we're moving to the suburbs, et cetera, et cetera. But never before in this country and never before in New York City have neighborhoods been colonized like they're being colonized now by Americans. That hasn't happened. The Dutch did it, of course, the British, but not by Americans within the United States. And there's a correlation between what's happening in our cities and what we're doing abroad. It's like our foreign policy and our domestic policy. We're clamping down.
There used to be a kind of a wall of sorts that existed on the east side of Manhattan at 96th Street. It's where all the good white folks got off the train. You do not go north of 96th Street into Harlem at risk of your very life. You know, your life's force. They'll destroy you, and make things out of your body parts after they finish with your wallet. This was basically the vibe, at least this was, like, you know, the belief, the fundamentally racist belief of many folks in New York who rarely, if ever, went north of 96th Street, and. About a year, year and a half, a couple years ago, I was performing, doing a play at the Apollo Theater, and kind of landed at LaGuardia and, you know, took this cab over to the theater. And I was crossing, you know, going across down 125th Street. It's around 7 o'clock at night. It's the fall, so it's already dark. And, dude, there were, like, lots of white people on the street. And it was dark, and they didn't even look scared. I was like, you know, it's like visiting Wonderland. Like, what the, you know, like, white people on 125th Street, and it's dark out. You know, and you know, they're just kind of milling around all happy, you know, and there were, like, lots of, like, you know, yellow cabs to be found. Like, yellow cabs also stopped service on 96th Street, and if you were uptown of that, you had to get a gypsy cab if you got anything. You know, and it really began to, like, you know, just that one crosstown cab ride, it set in. I was like, wow, like, this has fundamentally shifted. Like, real estate in Manhattan has become so incredibly valuable that white people have overcome their fear of blacks. That it's so valuable, they're like, you know, these niggas scare me, but not that much.
but it's also, it's the Bill factor. It's Bill Clinton and Bill Bratton. That's his name, right? You got him here. I didn't want to say it out loud. It's like bad vibes. But you know, Giuliani set into this, set this thing in motion in terms of the rezoning to price out small business owners, the mom and pop businesses, and bring in the chain stores, and really shift zoning around and deregulate housing. And then he put his police chief, who was that guy at the time, to clean up the city, to make it safe for Americans. Make it safe for Americans to come spend money here as tourists, and make it safe for Americans to come spend money here as homeowners. And then Bill Clinton moved to Harlem. And I was like, oh, no. It's on now. Like, this is, you know, and this is what you're feeling on 125th Street. Because originally, in marginal neighborhoods, which Harlem was one, it wasn't rich new white folks that were moving in. It was the sort of fringes who couldn't afford to live in the West Village, right? So it's like, all right, we're going to move to Harlem, and, like, it's cool. And, you know, it's kind of gritty, man, you know? Like, I dig it. It feels like a real neighborhood, this character in my show says. I like it because it feels like a real neighborhood. And you know, in one night, Giuliani said, all the homeless got to get off the street, and if you don't go to the unsafe, dirty shelter, then you're going to jail. Literally. That's where we had 400,000 homeless people in New York City, and they disappeared. So we think. So that kind of safety, it's like you don't have to know about the death and destruction that was happening here before, and it's okay. And you're sort of, yeah, you're walking around clueless, and there's a lot of cluelessness happening. But it's because of the erasure of what has happened. Now, I don't want to also, you know, make a mistake here, because it wasn't just a crack epidemic and it wasn't just death and destruction that was happening in our neighborhoods. There was good stuff going on, too. But we also had this bad stuff happening. And now what has happened, it seems, is this inequitable erasure, because essentially what the economic system of gentrification has done, it says, well, if you want to get rid of the bad stuff, then you got to get rid of your good stuff too. So the neighborhood cultural institutions are getting shut down, and no more dominoes on the block. It's illegal now, you know? You can't play dominoes outside. The developer character in my show, he says, people don't feel safe when you're playing dominoes in front of their house. That's not how it works in the real world. Because it's all about real estate, and it's all about, you know, making who feel safe. Anyway, I'm just going off on a tangent here.
Let me ask you, what if I haven't decided, just so you know, because the spot's still open, I haven't decided which two white people I'm going to save. You know, when Obama is sworn in, black people, we're each allowed to save two white people. And the rest of you will report to the docks. You'll be put on the ships for God knows where. What white people can I blame for this? Who can I point a finger at? Because there's got to be some white person that I can exclude from my list of to be saved, just right off the top.
Wow. Well, again, this is tough. This is a tough question because...
Where do race and class commingle in this issue?
Okay. The first character in my piece, I don't want to give too much away here, but he starts off with blaming white folks, you know, from everywhere. Wisconsin,
awesome.
Missouri, Arizona, California is a biggie. But then he says, you black crackers from Minneapolis who are living in the lofts over on Berry Street, and all you Latino crackers from Miami and San Diego, you Latino tech boom crackers who are living on Kent Avenue in these new developments, and all you Asian grunged out slummers from Seattle. Because although race is a big factor, it's not just about race. It's about class, and it's about how we feel entitled with money in our pockets as Americans to live wherever we want to live, and to spend however we want to spend, and to go to the cafe and to feel authentic at the neighborhood spot, and to take over a neighborhood without feeling like we're taking over, but feeling like we're part of it, feeling like we're contributing. We want to point the finger at Giuliani. We want to point the finger at Bratton. We want to point the finger at Bill Clinton because he moved to Harlem, that motherfucker. But we also have to point the finger at ourselves. Like, I was sitting around with a bunch of my friends from Williamsburg, Brooklyn, right, complaining about gentrification, complaining about how, you know, how after, you know, 30 years of asking for a school and 20 years of asking for a hospital and 15 years of asking for a traffic light on this corner where four young people have been killed, we get nothing. And after 6 months, these housing activists get a bike lane. Makes you want to blow some shit up, right? So we're like sitting there complaining, and then my boy says, well, wait a second. Do you have soy milk in your refrigerator? And I was like, no, I have almond milk. And I was like, what about you?
I have Sorrel.
And he's like, yeah, I got rice milk. You know, I'm allergic to soy. And I was like, what about you? And before we knew it, like the five of us sitting around the table here realized that's like $100 worth of alternative nut milks, you know, that we got in our refrigerators. So, like, what the hell are we talking about? You know, because that's an economic footprint that we are complicit with.
Were you having that conversation from the lobby of Whole Foods?
from the revolutionary headquarters.
Yeah.
But we're all contributing to this because of how we spend our money. It's like we can't not. What am I going to say? All right, well, you know, like I try to only shop in the Puerto Rican and Dominican spots, right? But those spots are getting shut down. You know, I need to go get whatever, my almond milk, or I need to go get something from the, you know, I need to make copies at a store. Like it becomes a matter of convenience, and everything has become about convenience that crosses race and crosses class. It's like, hey, I got money, I'm going to spend it. Therefore, I deserve. Therefore, I am not guilty. Therefore, I am guilty.
When this is a really hits centrally to the complexity of life, I think, in urban centers throughout America and around the world. These are not issues just of, obviously not just issues of race, obviously not just issues of class. There's also issues of culture. There's also issues not really so much of class as economy. You know, there the economy has been set up and streamlined so as to funnel our efforts and our choices on the path with least resistance is often the path that has the most impact and the most negative impact. And then you begin to feel taxed if you have to make choices outside of that path of least resistance. If you have to, you know, put some thought into, you know, where you're shopping, you know, like, well, I should have to think about where I get my almond milk from, you know, and this is, and so there, what I'm saying is that ultimately there's almost a conspiracy of riches that are out there to kind of shackle us into this consumer mentality of, you know, if they got us buying and spending and bullshitting about politics, as long as we're buying and spending, it's all good. You know, it seems like a broad trap that there's, you know, very few ways out of. Wow, this is really getting kind of dark and depressing, isn't it? Anyway, it's a like trap. It's a trap.
It's a trap because it would seem that there's very little alternatives to, for lack of a better term, selling out, right? I want to talk about this term that's in our title, which I didn't come up with. It's called neo-feudalism. There's a writer named Vijay Prashad who writes about this. And what the idea is that this gentrification that's happening in this country is neo-feudalism. Like, if you look at the feudal model, right, there were these kings and queens, or royalty, rich people, and they lived in castles in medieval times, right? And they got the serfs to build their castles, and then the serfs had to go live on the other side of the moat and toil in the fields. But then the royalty wanted to spiff up their castle. So they were like, we need some serfs living on the castle grounds to keep it looking beautiful, right? Before they knew it, there were more serfs living on the castle grounds than there were royalty and vassals. And the serfs brought these problems with them from toiling on the other side of the moat. So the rich people were like, whoa, this is feeling unsafe now. Like, we know we wanted this, you know, really to get better, but now we're feeling unsafe because there's more of them than us. So they fled and they moved off to their country estate in the suburbs, i.e. white flight. And 20 or 30 years pass by, and the serfs stay in the castle. They, you know, they take over the castle, they occupy it, they fix it up for themselves. And now the children of the kings and the queens and the vassals are bored out of their minds living on the country estate in the suburbs, right? Like I said, they want to go eat real food and listen to real music and feel like real people. So they come to the castle and they come knocking on the door and they're like, hey, we want to hang out. And the serfs are like, who the hell are y'all, right? And it's like, well, you know, we're cool and we're young and we want to hang out. And they say, no. Well, half of them say, no, you can't come here. We fixed this place up for us. You left. But the other half of the serfs say, wait a second. How much money did you say you were going to pay me? A month for my place? And this is what I'm finding that's happening too, is that, you know, I'm connected with a whole bunch of people in my neighborhood talking about this very issue, but right next door, literally every other house is someone who's ready to sell. Like, I'm just waiting for the right price, Papi.
Right.
You give me 1.5 million, I move to Whitestone. I'll be happy. I move to Long Island, right? Like, you know, on one line, it's like, can you believe what's happening here? But if someone writes me a check, then I'm out. So what do you do? What do you do? How do you make that decision? When you feel like your community is being dismantled and then there's money involved and people are just, I mean, there is money like in the streets, how people are spending money. Recession? What recession? There's new bars. And keep in mind this. Between 1998 and 2002, 350 new bars opened up in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. There were already 150 new ones that opened up in the 3 years before that. 350 new bars. So new ones that opened up this year in the recession on a Monday night last week are full. You can't even get in. And I'm like, recession? No. Because they're still coming here. Because Kentucky's not cool. Montana's not cool. Arizona's not cool. Suburban New Jersey's not cool. Brooklyn is cool. Here's my money.
Looking back from a kind of historical perspective on a long timeline, going back some 5,000 years in the past and maybe 5,000 years in the future, if you look at that long timeline and, you know, then Jesus was around and, you know, some crimes in the Middle Ages and what have you, just about 150 years ago, we discovered petroleum and found uses for it, right? And with the discovery of petroleum, of course, there's all this human activity and, you know, everything gets amped up, everything moves much more quickly, et cetera. But it's a little spike on this giant 10,000-year human timeline, which could be even longer, but just
shorten it to that 10,000-year period. Imagine that discovery of the petroleum right in the middle. And it's a spike of discovery that we were born during this time of petroleum. Well, and it's a resource that's running out. And I'm getting a whole big thing about peak oil, but the net is many of the decisions we make about capitalism, how we spend money, how we commute, how we travel, how we build suburbs, roads, etc. These are all functions, not even exclusively of capitalism, our economy, but particularly this petroleum-based economy, where we have this vision that we can do whatever we want because petroleum's cheap, and we can move from Kentucky to Los Angeles, etc. And it's part of the disconnect, the continued disconnect that we all live in. We don't understand. We don't have an appreciation for the fact that this petroleum is shipped to us from halfway around the world, and we're paying huge sums of money to protect these trade routes and all these conflicts we're involved in, etc. And we don't understand the byproducts of this economy that we live in. And one of those byproducts is this type of gentrification, where there's nothing that's localized. The food isn't localized. The travel in the region isn't localized. We consider the entire world our oyster. And we can only do this for a limited period of time in which we can continue to do this before everything's going to have to change. But in the meantime, this is a function of our kind of gentrified petroleum-based economy. Am I just like really crazy on the crack pipe and no, somewhere else, or do you understand the
that's like
point?
That's the advanced course.
The advanced course. Yeah, but there really is like, you know, there's this. We don't understand the secondary causes of the entire economy on which our culture is built, and gentrification, and the ability to move around, cheap oil, cheap travel, is a result of that. And because imagine oil's not cheap. Imagine there's no oil. Imagine it does take you 6 months to get, you know, some period of time, or it's $10,000 or $20,000 for you to go to Europe. Now all of a sudden, you're not really thinking, well, I have to go to Paris to be a fashion photographer. All of a sudden, you're thinking in different terms. And the point that I'm getting at is that it distorts the way you look at the world, because it makes everything cheap and close comparatively if you're a rich American versus someone living in a village in Dakar. We continue to kind of look at, because I can feel people are like, what the hell is he talking about? And it's this disconnect we have, this lack of appreciation for the impact of capitalism, and particularly petroleum dollars, on our economy, that everything we're talking about now is largely based on that, because we're talking about mass migrations of people all over the world, particularly first world people.
It's made this simulated struggle that I'm talking about easier to do. If you move to a city, and again, to simulate struggle. I mean, there's a character in my play who, she dropped out of NYU, and she says, you know, I've been here through only 3 years, but so much has changed already, you have no idea. But I liked it when it was a little grittier here. Like you said at the beginning, you know, everybody who's been here 1 week thinks that the people came after them, fucked it all up. And I think what we're going to start to see now, because of this convenience, right? We were talking backstage about this strip mall phenomena, is an intense effort to make things look organic and authentic, that we've all sort of strip malled everything, and made everything convenient, petroleum-based, and corn-based, too. That's a whole other conversation. But to the point where there's no more feeling of authenticity for community, whether we've left our community or moved to another community or taken over somebody else's. We want to feel authentic. We want to feel community. So that's why I crack up when I see Applebee's Neighborhood Bar and Grill, because they all look like they were made in a factory. And they put them in places where there are no neighborhoods, to simulate the idea of a neighborhood, right? So now what has happened, Williamsburg, Brooklyn, for an example, is you have a neighborhood that for a long time was Puerto Rican and Dominican, Hasidic, Satmar Jewish, Polish, and Italian American. And a lot of those institutions, those specific cultural institutions, whether they were cafes or supermarkets or bars or whatever predominantly have disappeared. And the new places that are being put there are now being artificially distressed. Do you know what I'm talking about?
House of Blues, etc.
So, like, they'll take a place that used to be a, I don't know, a guitar factory and keep the old bricks, but paint it and then distress the paint to make it look like it was an old beer brewery. And people will pay more to buy a beer there because they think that they're in an old brewery. A lot of these old factory buildings are being turned into lofts. And there was one they used to rent apartments in that I actually lived in for a year or two. And now they're selling as luxury condominiums. And to raise the prices, they put steel girders on the outside and rusted them to make it look like it was more of an old factory, even though it was an old factory, actually. They wanted to make it look more like it was an old factory because then they could get $2 million an apartment, not $1 million an apartment. So now we're sort of paying for this false idea or illusion of authenticity because we've stripped or strip-mined our communities of what was an authentic feeling of, you know, organic, I don't know, community and place.
You know, we've kind of moved from the cities, some of us have anyway, into the suburbs and exurbs, and now there's this massive movement back into the cities for a whole range of reasons. And with that, there becomes this whole issue of displacement. When the suburbs, you're displacing, you know, you being all of us, we're displacing, you know, deer and crops and, you know, insects and what have you. And as that stilted life, as we decide that we want something else, we want the vibrancy of the cities, you move into the cities, and of course there's a displacement that happens with that as well. And I think part of it is we need to have, ideally, you know, and maybe we don't, maybe I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about, but it'd strike me that we would serve ourselves better to have more of an awareness of our impact and the impact of our choices and the impact on how we move through the world, as opposed to assuming that just because you can pay the bill at the end of the month, it's all good.
I don't know how all good it is.
Yeah. Well, why don't we do that? Did you want to last?
No.
Okay. You sure? Okay, we're going to open up this conversation to you, the audience, and if you have question or comment, just raise your hand and we'll try to get to you. This gentleman here in the striped sweater.
Hi. I guess I'm supposed to say I'm a New Yorker because I grew up in New York.
Did you move there after college?
No, I left there after college. No. I admire some of your observations in these categories of gentrification and so on, but I especially towards the end of what you've been saying, it sounds as if you were unaware of what was happening 20 years ago or 30 years ago, because all of the things you've just been talking about have happened once before, at least once mm-hmm. before, when I lived in New York in the late 60s. That was the period of exposed brick walls and making things look urban rustic. And
spider plants. And
the people from the suburbs were coming back. There was, the people who had gone out in the 50s seemed to have discovered that by the 70s that, the city was maybe offered more. On gentrification, I'm not quite sure I understand about this gentrification and colonialism, since this has been going on for probably a century, if not more. The last place I lived in New York was in Little Italy, when Little Italy was Little Italy, and you had to be Italian to live there, and I only got a place because I knew somebody who introduced me to the super. And when I went out into the street, after I moved there, I looked at the street signs in the neighborhood, and they were Eldridge Street and Elizabeth Street and Mott Street. And none of this seemed very Italian to me, nor did St. Patrick's Church, which was up the street. And what I learned was that the neighborhood had been built for Italian immigrants, for Irish immigrants. And then they moved uptown, and then the neighborhood, perhaps in your terminology, was colonized by Italians. But neighborhoods change all the time, and cities change. I mean, this is part of history and urban development. So maybe you could address some of these issues.
Well, I think, again, I don't think the neighborhood was colonized by Italian immigrants, because when a group of people colonizes a community or a country, again, they come with wealth and they come with weapons, usually, or a Bible, and or some sort of spiritual book. There's a difference between neighborhoods changing over, again, from one immigrant to community to the next because of waves of immigration. I think what's happening now that's different is that the people that are colonizing or changing over neighborhoods are Americans within the United States. And it's not just migration. It's they're coming en masse with collective wealth that amounts into the tens and billions of dollars. Like I was just saying, you know, New York University and Columbia University are some of the largest real estate companies in New York City, because they made a smart decision from an economic standpoint about 15, 20 years ago by saying that the money is not in the tuition for the education. The money is in the real estate. The money is in that when all these kids, when we get this city safe enough and we get someone like Giuliani in office, when we get these kids to come here, do you know how much money they're going to spend when they go to the bars and to the vintage clothing stores and to the Thai restaurant and to the Burmese restaurant and to the French patisserie? We need to own all the buildings that those places are in. And that's different than one immigrant neighborhood changing over to another immigrant neighborhood.
And a lot of the immigrant neighborhoods, too, not to discount what you're saying, because there is a trend of, like, neighborhoods change and over time, but their gentrification is a little different than, you know, immigrants would arrive in New York and they would try to, you know, the first generation, maybe the best they could do is whatever menial labor they could get. Their kids would tend to do better, particularly if they were white and, you know, they change their name and they speak perfect English and next, you know, they're off to some house in the suburbs. So there was a move to better quarters as opposed to them, you know, seeking out a place to a section of the city to make it better or take away the homes from the folks that were there, either by force or not. Over here?
I was just thinking about this idea that you mentioned, thinking about what is one's authentic home. I mean, my parents were New Yorkers, so I feel very at home in New York. I grew up here in L.A. They moved here after the war. But my grandparents came from Poland, so I've been, you know, in Poland I feel at home too. But what is one's authentic home? I mean, it seems like it's almost, I've always thought it was like this birthright that people move on, you know, and because it's in my family, it's always been that way. Although, can one come back to an authentic home, you know? I don't think that value that you talk about staying in a place is really something that has been very prevalent in American culture for a really long time, and maybe not in European culture either. So maybe would you that or unpack that a little?
I think.
Let me bring this home real quick on the
sure.
oil factor, because I want to return to this. This is exactly what I'm saying. Like, folks, many folks in many places in Europe chose to stay there for a variety of reasons. Some chose to move, but there's been such a high level of migration in America because of this oil economy, because of cars, because of cheap oil. It's not just the trains, because when we just had trains going around, there was a lot less migration happening throughout America than when we moved to the automobile, than when we moved to this culture. And we have a much higher level of this movement, I think, than we would if we did not have this petroleum-based economy. And if you look at Historically, if you look at Europe in the late 1800s, late 1700s, yeah, there was always some level of movement, but nothing that approached movement of the 20th century and the constant movement of the 20th century. And that and those were the oil years, the boom years for that.
There's something unique about this country that's unlike Europe, that in terms of what you're talking about with it, with Europe, that on the holidays, you can't, if you haven't booked ahead, you can't get a plane, train, or bus ticket because everyone's going home for the holidays. And they haven't gone, maybe in their minds, again, they've gone for economic reasons to wherever they've migrated to, for the job in Chicago or the job in Miami or the job in Los Angeles. But there wasn't, they weren't going to die if they didn't leave where they're from. They're not, they didn't live in the Congo, or they didn't live in any of the number of countries that are being obliterated by U.S. economic policy and G8 economic policy, where they're forced to go to Europe and forced to go to the United States to send money home. The money's not being sent home from the Americans. The money is being spent where they live, but yet they're going home. So where is home then? It's a very difficult question to answer. I like to think that home is a place that you're invested in, not just economically, but you suffer a consequence if someone who lives in your hometown gets shot by the police. That you suffer that consequence too, because you live there and you share this home. That you suffer a consequence if a school on the other side of your town, because it's your town, gets shut down. If you don't suffer those consequences, is it really your home? Or are you just living in an entitled vacuum? You know what I'm saying? Because these kids who are moving to my block, they don't care, you know, whether the school around the corner has books. They don't care if the hospital, you know, that's 25 blocks away has enough doctors working at night, because they're going to be okay, because it's not really their home. They're sort of on a vacation, if you will. Even though they may be working at a job, even though they may be paying the rent, they're kind of on vacation because everything has been designed for them to feel comfortable and safe. But for the people who have been living there and struggling and invested in the community, things are still not safe. So I don't know who, and maybe I'm not right either. I don't know.
We can get a question on this side of the room, the gentleman in the baseball cap, and then we'll try to get the other one also.
Thank you. I'm third generation Michiganese. My grandmother drove over here on a motorcycle. Anyways.
From the Northern Peninsula.
Something I think I just want to curtail on what you were just saying, and that's maybe, Jerry, the people that were questioning the Topanga violin teacher were taking action in their own community and were worried about whether or not he was going to molest their children. And so maybe they are taking an active role in their community and they don't need to go to Afghanistan. But more importantly, I just wanted to thank you guys for bringing up the question of, or actually discussing the topic of how class and race intermingle in this discussion, because I've been pondering this thing I read by Jared Diamond recently, not in any of his popular books, but particularly this one journal. I forget the name of the article, but I'm sorry, but he says, as sort of a quoted text, not quoted, I mean, just sort of trying to remember it. I can't quote it correctly, but he says something to the effect, race will one day lie, the concept of race will one day lie in the same annals as the myths that be shared with the myths of people, you know, as the myths like, as the myth, what am I trying to say? You know, the whole concept of the world being flat, you know, it'll be on par with that. That's what race will be considered. Because
white people invented that myth.
Right, you know, he is white. But, I mean, I think what you're writing towards is something like that, because race you know, it all the people that lived in the serfdom or in the feudal society were of the same skin color. And now we're just starting to see it mix. We're starting to see it mix. And we're starting to realize that race really is a concept that is a lie that has been ingrained in us. I'm not saying it doesn't exist and doesn't have an effect on society. So I'm just saying it's a myth.
Well, it's good. It's cool now that, you know, Barack Obama will be president. So we all know now formally and officially racism is over. No more racism. It's done, just like when Margaret Thatcher became head of Great Britain. No more misogyny in the UK. It was done. It was done. Vagina in charge. Done. It's a wrap. You know, and not to belabor the point too much, but, you know, when I was being, you know, maybe perhaps a little cruel when I said they need to march their kids to Afghanistan, what I was really getting at was this culture of coddling that we have here. Everyone wants to care for their kids. Everyone wants their children to be safe. But there's this kind of increasing movement here where some parents take it to the extreme. And what I mean by that is every little aspect of their child's life needs to be programmed and approved, and this vetting process, et cetera. And, you know, fortunately, everyone didn't grow up like me, you know, kind of having to light cigarettes for their dad and, you know, and drinking whiskey at five. You know, I get things have changed from the 70s. But at the same time, like, you know, you don't, you know, need to have this sense of protection for your kids that's completely unrealistic in the world. And I think that's kind of in my, you know, perhaps unclever and mean-spirited way what I was trying to get at, that we have too much time and energy to program the most minute aspects sometimes of our children's lives. And we're not all like that, but there is a movement among folks like that, and that's kind of what I was referring to. This woman here in the black shirt.
Hello. By the way, making almond milk is very easy. Okay.
I know. I got the book.
Okay.
You're going to buy a machine. It's like $20 and you just grind it.
I am born and raised from Los Angeles.
Representa?
Yes. And I think one of the biggest frustrations I've had with gentrification that I think a lot of people coming from the East Coast or just people coming into Los Angeles don't seem to understand is the displacement of families. And in Los Angeles, I've noticed that immigrant communities like Echo Park and Silver Lake and Atwater and downtown Los Angeles, even now the Pico Union area and the MacArthur Park, you know, it's the immigrant families that are being targeted. You know, and them as a whole entire group. I mean, Skid Row now, you see families homeless. You don't just see individuals. You see complete families. And if you ever drive there in the morning, you will see parents getting their kids ready to send them off to school. Because they used to live in MacArthur Park, and now, you know, the cool, we call them hipsters, you know, come in and they're living in hardcore in MacArthur Park. But my question to you, Danny, because I'm very interested in this, is in your show, are you going to be dealing with displacement?
I deal with it to a certain extent, but I tell you, there's not enough room in my play to deal with every aspect of gentrification. It's just a 90-minute play, and there are like 50 characters missing from my show. It's funny because when I was workshopping it, I had some post-show discussions, and my director and I asked the audience, you know, do you feel that there's any characters missing? And everybody raised their hands because everybody has 30 stories about gentrification and, you know, they want to see it represented on stage. So what I would like to see, I don't know, maybe I may write this, is what happens after people get displaced? And because I know what happens in the place that the displacement happened in, but what happens after that? What we're starting to see now is, I didn't know that it was happening like that in Los Angeles, but around the country, like people ask me, like, you know, where are people going that get kicked out of Williamsburg or get kicked out of Harlem or the South Bronx, which is called SoBro now? I'm not kidding.
That's why there are gun laws.
Yeah. And essentially, the only place that people can go, it's like, the moat line is getting drawn further and further out because the castle is getting bigger. So what's on the other side of the city is the suburbs. But if there are still middle class and rich people living in certain suburbs, then the only place for displaced people to go outside of most cities are suburbs where there's nothing. There's no school, there's no hospital, there's no transportation system. And this is what we're seeing, is that that's where a lot of folks are being forced to go. So,
Palmdale.
Yeah. I don't know where that is,
yeah,
but I imagine.
That's our no school zone.
Yeah, like Nyack, New York, and like suburban Trenton, New Jersey, or Brentwood, Long Island.
Chislehurst.
What?
Chislehurst, New Jersey. Yeah, same.
Yeah, like these obscure places, like all of a sudden there's like, you know, a crack trade and gang violence, and because there's the scale of poverty appears out of nowhere because of all the displaced people, and there's no infrastructure, and there's no support system, and there's no resources. There's no municipality even to handle that. So it's like,
We're going to have time for a couple more questions. This gentleman back here with the black shirt on.
Hi. Just to go back to your point, Danny, about the residents of Brooklyn who are all willing to cash out during these
all of them, half of them.
Not all the residents, but all the residents that you talk about who are willing to cash out. Because, I mean, these people are members of a neighborhood, but these people are also individuals. And because there's such a great incentive on the table, is it really worth it to have a conscience? And if you say it is, do you expect the people of Brooklyn do you expect that it's worth it for them to have a conscience in that situation with such a big incentive on the table?
What should the neighborhood do, Danny?
I don't know. I don't really have, unfortunately, I'm so depressed by the situation that I don't have any expectations of anybody anymore.
You're a Democrat.
Yeah. There you go. Not really. It's difficult. Look, I've been talking to a lot of people in my neighborhood who've been there for even longer than me, and I've been there going on 20 years. And they're ready to cash out now. Some of them are like, this sucks, we want to stay here, but we don't like it here anymore because we feel like tourists in our own neighborhood. I feel like a tourist, not just in my own neighborhood, in the whole city, I feel like a tourist. So the incentive is the money, and then where do you go? Do you go displace somebody else? I mean, I like to think that I'm a conscious person. I don't want to stay in my neighborhood anymore because I feel like it's been completely overrun with hipsters and cafes that I don't feel comfortable in, and restaurants that I don't feel comfortable in. I can't really recognize what's on the menu. And so I'm like, wow, I want to leave. But then where do I go without displacing somebody else?
Pompeo.
Especially when I've been invested in this community. That's what's up. I'm going to write that down.
That's what's up.
Especially when I feel like I have been invested in the health of the community since I arrived. You know, involved with various organizations, involved with young people, involved in contributing. So I feel like, wow, I kind of feel at this point like I've lost this battle because I feel like, well, what have I been contributing for? If nobody gets to reap the benefits, none of us are getting to reap the benefits of all the contribution and all the sacrifice. Well, then if somebody offers me a check for my house, I should just move. I mean, I was like in my rental car yesterday, like, damn, it's sunny here. Let me go displace somebody, you know? How do I do that compassionately? How do I compassionately displace somebody? You know, I was like, I get my whole spiel ready, but I contribute. But I'm volunteering.
Okay, we're in this woman here with the glasses there in the back. Yeah.
The gentrification in downtown LA is fueled by Bratton, and I don't know if everybody knows about Safer Cities Initiative in this city, but it is the most violent and and abusive of human rights thing that I think could probably is going on in our country. There are as many residents as there are on Skid Row. That's how many citations have been issued in the first year of Safer Cities. Those people are being displaced right into jail, county jail. And, well, I just want to make sure everybody knows that. We don't have Giuliani. We have a kind of progressive mayor, but when it comes to the big bucks behind gentrification, we got the same tactics and the same planning that you guys got in New York, but I suspect it's on a bigger level here. If you were on Skid Row like today, you see squadrons of police cars like moving down the road and right bold-faced violating the sanctions against them. They're not supposed to randomly ask people if they're on parole or probation, but they violate people's rights on a daily basis, and that's what's really fueling downtown's groovy cafes and stuff. So
You have like the people's rights versus the potential for hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in real estate. It's, you know, surprise, surprise, the rights of those can poor, disenfranchise, you know, people with chemical imbalances and, you know, perhaps drug addicted as a way of self-medicating. This clearly falls by the wayside. We're going to try to squeeze in one more question here, this gentleman over here in the blue.
Thank you. I'm thinking of an example of a specific urban community that reminds me that the conversation so far seems to be very much in black and white terms, not just racially, but...
That's life.
Yeah. Well, it's not. And especially when you're talking about cities. I mean, it's so much more complicated. But I'm thinking about the Castro. I'm thinking about West Hollywood. I'm thinking about Chelsea. And I think historically, if you think about it, at least since the 1960s, gays are notorious gentrifiers or colonizers, as you like to put it. And many gay people come to cities and they leave the small towns that you're arguing that they should go back to escape the persecution of small town life. And it's the very inauthenticity of cities, the very alienation and anonymity that we experience in cities that afford gay people a space to create a community and a lifestyle free from the prejudices and discriminations of small town rural communities. So I think that, you know, if we talk about it in terms of race or even race and class, then fine. It is very much an either or black and white kind of a predicament, and you're either authentic or inauthentic. But when you throw in other factors like gender or especially sexuality, it's a much more complicated picture, I think. And I think in that sense, the city creates a certain kind of freedom that, at least historically, gays and other social groups, not just sexual minorities, but other ethnic and cultural minorities have taken advantage of that anonymity that cities afford. And yes, there is, of course, a class dimension to it and a racial dimension to it, but I think it's a lot more complicated than the way we're talking about it tonight.
I appreciate you bringing that up. And I don't disagree with you at all, but to play devil's advocate here, I have to posit that the pilgrims said the same thing. That we were afforded the anonymity of North America, the original pilgrims. The artists say it. The super left-wing activists say it. Religious people say it. And I'm not saying that, trust me, I'm not saying it's easy to stay in Kansas. And I don't know what that is, to stay in Kansas or to stay in small town life. But I feel that no matter who we are, we seem to be desperate to justify our presence in someone else's space. And that anonymity that you're talking about is real, but it's an anonymity that comes from feeling entitled to create a community in a place where you think there is none. Because it's not as if the gay community moved into a parking lot where there was nothing there in Chelsea, or moved into the Castro where there were no people living there. Nor is it the same for, you know, the artists who moved into Williamsburg, or the Jehovah's Witnesses who moved into downtown Brooklyn. So it's, I guess what, you know, people come up to me and they say, well, what's the message? You know, like, what is the message that you, now that you've said these really offensive things?
That's your point.
Right. And I just feel like there isn't a message except a plea for us all to be more conscious about whose space we are occupying. We are all occupying somebody else's space. And how do we live in that space, especially if we call it home?
The, you know,
we're not.
Whatever, I'm part of the issue. It didn't start after me. And part of it also is the choices we make. I know someone that I was working with who wanted to have about realistically $400,000 or $500,000 worth of work done on her home. And she was trying to have it done for $250,000. Okay. And when she didn't like the slowness of the bids she got back from people because they were trying to figure out ways to cut corners, she gave them these horrible ratings on Angela's List or whatever, and was just incensed that she couldn't have a half million dollar upgrade for $250,000, and how dare these people hold it back from her. And there wasn't even a thought for a moment as she went through this big upgrade on her home on what that meant to cut those corners in the lives of the workers that would be hired to do that, or even the impact it would have beyond her desire to have a nicer home. Now, we all want nice homes. There's nothing wrong with that. Like, you know, I love my fucking wooden floors. I love them. But that is community, I think, if you seek to take advantage of the people who are contributing to where you live in one way or another, and you expand or upgrade your lifestyle at their expense, I think that's central to community. I'm not saying that you did that or anyone else. This is an example of a person I work with who did this. And part of the decision-making process, I think, should be around how do we relate to each other, how do we treat each other, and what is it that, is this a fair exchange or fair trade, or are we just getting the best deal we possibly can?
Yeah, I can't. I don't know if I can answer your question. All I know is this, is that your story, right, and my story, maybe, in the scheme of classism and racism, matter more. And that's unfair. It matters more.
The fact that you would say that is an indication, and I don't mean this to me, the fact that you could say, why does it matter more, is an indication of your white privilege. The fact that it has to be explained to you,
that's
why it matters more. And I don't mean, honestly, this is not an attack in any way at all, man. It's an indication of the fact that you could not understand that the white privilege that you possess makes your point of view more culturally and historically valid, has more currency than that of people of color.
No. Right. Right. Okay. There's something. This is only going to get more
difficult. This is
going
to happen, Danny. Look, you shouldn't be surprised. I told you to start. He hates white people. I told you this.
This is only going to get more complicated. There's another writer named Adrian.
You do have to wrap up.
Yeah, we have to wrap up. There's a writer named Adrian Piper, and she talks about something called white people's fatigue. This is going to sound less volatile maybe coming out of my mouth in this context. And what that means is that we, right, as white folks, as privileged white folks in this country, no matter how unprivileged we may feel, okay, is that we have an allergy, that's the word, okay, to having the finger pointed at us again and again saying, but you did this and you're doing this and you don't belong and blah, 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 and community, da, 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 da. And what we just want to know is, like what you said, where are we supposed to be? No, what am I supposed to do? Well, then what's right and what's wrong? And I think what my point is that it is very complicated, that it is not black and white, and that that's the only way that we would like to see it, most of us, because it's easy. We want to know what is the easy way to fix this problem so that we don't feel guilty. Because it's easy. No, hold on. But if you weren't disturbed by this conversation, then the question would not have arisen. And these are the letters that I get. Your question is identical to one of the letters that I got, to several of the letters that I got. It's a constant justification of our presence. And yes, I... Right, exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
Oh, that's not entirely true.
So...
That's all right. Obama doesn't take me from tragic to magic. It's all good.
Yeah. And continue to get angry.
We do have to wrap. We really have to wrap this. I just want to say. To address this is through dialogues like this. You know, Danny doesn't have the answers. I don't have the answers. None of us individually do. It really is part of a community dialogue. And this is critical. Your participation and your decision to be here tonight is a critical part of that. And I really want to thank the library for facilitating this. And I really want to encourage you folks to support the Los Angeles Public Library, consider being a member or something else, because this is a critical community space where these types of dialogues can happen. And if you walk out upset or not, doesn't matter. We need spaces like this, and they really should be supported as best we can. And it was my hope that you leave maybe a little fucking pissed off and maybe a little upset, and you continue this conversation, you know, in your homes and your dinner tables, and as you continue to disenfranchise black people. Thank you all so much for coming.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.